Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Rin Wednesday. My co-host is Adam Wybray. Today we're talking about The Amazing Digital Circus. A transcript of this episode will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy! Good evening, Adam.
Good evening, Ren. I'm melting.
Oh, poor Adam in the southeast of England is experiencing a heat wave.
Yeah, I probably look something like the Gloink Queen. that we're going to be discussing in today's episode. I'm lathered in my own sweat. There we go. That's a horrible but realistic description of how I am. It is sweltering here. It's really, really hot. So I've been off work today. The school was closed for the day, so I've been marking and did so in the climate centre that I co-founded in Ipswich in the hope that I could do my civic duty by plying the good people of Ipswich with free cold drinks, because everyone looks so hot and like they're almost fainting in town. I thought that'd be nice, but I only had one person take me up on the offer. I was there for hours. I had two people come in. One person had a drink. The other woman who came in didn't have a drink. And though she believed in climate change, she definitely did not believe in vaccines. And I heard all about that.
Oh, well.
I did. And it got a bit overwhelming. Something along the lines of, because I've been injected with vaccines, I've been injected with babies, which was quite a troubling notion.
So
my philanthropic endeavour didn't quite go to plan. But you said people never trust free stuff.
You have to really, really persuade them, the average person, to take something for free. it's a bit of an odd one. I think you're up to something.
I mean, maybe I need to make Ipswich Umbrella look more like a conference centre, because I feel like people love free handouts at conference centres. They'll always take the jelly beans and little mouse mats. I mean, back when you got mouse mats. You remember remember mouse mats?
It's very relevant. Very relevant topic. Topically, I don't know when this will come out. Probably not topically. But,
no, you know, we need to... I'm going to be on editing this one.
We need to... turn this one around, because
we do.
Because we're talking about The Amazing Digital Circus.
Welcome to The Amazing Digital Circus! My name is Kane, I'm your ringmaster, and I'm here to show you the most jaw-dropping, heart-stopping, mind-bending paraphernalia you've ever laid your eyes upon! Isn't that right, Bubble?
That's right, Kane! I can't wait to see what you've got cooking up for today!
Well, let's not waste any time! Let's get right into the show!
This is the one where we hit the big time, Ren.
With our palatable mainstream opinions. About...
Yeah, did you see what AI says about us? I mean, I don't like to listen to AI.
No.
Yeah. Like, I'll see if I can...
What does AI say about us?
AI's got opinions about us, I have to say. So, yeah, I looked up, self-indulgently, I admit, reviews for our podcast to see. So, and AI said, you know, it's a popular podcast. People say nice things about it. They like the entertaining banter between me and you, and our quirky humour. But it said some people, I don't know who, some people criticise its focus on niche themes, and its unprofessional amateur production values or something.
Oh, wow. Shocking.
we are talking about an evil AI in this episode, and truly that was the evil AI saying such libelous things about Still Scared.
I know. My goodness.
I know. I mean, you know, we discuss hot mainstream topics like the Pogels.
The Mabinogion.
It's the all these things are the word on the street, and
so we're just talking about a little niche YouTuber thing with only several hundred million views.
Yeah, take that, AI.
And if you are listening to us, we are going to assume that you're one of the tens of millions of people who have watched this series on YouTube. So there will be spoilers, and we're not going to recount the plot beat by beat.
And don't get angry if, like, I mispronounce, like, I call the characters Bobble and Janks and... Pomity and things like that, you know, that's fine.
He's very hot, guys. He's
exactly. I'm really hot. I'm so hot.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know which characters fancy each other or you stan or are in standom relationships. I don't know. Okay, honestly. But I do have stickers of them, and I have put Digital Circus stickers on my work laptop, so that's quite nice.
Yeah, because you work with the youth.
I do work with the youth, and fortunately, quite a lot of youth like the Digital Circus. So I've been. However, I did see the film before some of them, so. I had to be very careful about spoilers because I had I was close to the line and kids were not impressed. So yeah.
So we both did go to see the final act in the cinema.
Oh, Ren, did you see it in 4DX?
No, I saw it in normal, but the cinema did have very big reclining seats, so that was quite nice.
And I guess if someone was, like, kicking your chair from behind, it would basically be the same.
did you see it in...
I did. I had to. I had no choice. I went along on opening day, ready and eager, and I was, like, the only adult not accompanied by a child there. this is actually true. and there were like some kids I taught in a primary school recently, like before I got this job, you know, doing supply teaching. They're like, oh, it's that teacher. And I sort of came over like, hey kids, yeah, I'm ready to see the Digital Circus, I'm quite excited. And they sort of looked awkward, I'm like, oh yeah. And then I couldn't get in.
Oh, damn.
Oh, It was a terrible time. and then I went to see it, and afterwards saw two of my old secondary school students, and I was like, yeah, I've just seen the Digital Circus, you know, pretty good. And they're like, yeah, we've just seen the Back Rooms. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. because
the humiliations continue.
Because I couldn't go and see it in regular 2D. I had to pay more because I was so keen to see it in 4DX.
Wow.
Which meant that every time that... what's the evil AI called? Clive? Clang? Kodos?
Kane.
Oh yeah, like Cain and Abel, I should remember. Yeah. Okay, Cain. Yeah. Anytime Cain popped bubble, there was like a horrible kind of poke in your back. Like, oh, you were God. Being popped. Like, imagine that your back was made of pustules and each one was being, popped when bubble was popped. It was horrid. I didn't like it. And then the funniest thing, I didn't realise that 4DX has smell-o-vision now.
Oh my God.
So the kind of backroomsy computer offices smell were, you know, really rank. But the worst smell was there's this stupid, like, it's fun, but a silly little throwaway joke. When Cain uses Kinga as some dental floss.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like
no,
a 30
Jax.
Second.
He uses Jax.
Oh, is it Jax? Dental. Okay, thank you. So it's like a 30 second throwaway joke. So for this joke, whoever had programmed the 4DX felt it necessary to pump in the synthetic smell of a dentist into the room. And it lingered for ages. It was properly nasty.
Well, that's nuts. Which is the dystopian novels, classic dystopian novels, is it that has a smell organ?
Gosh, I don't know. Is that, it seems like the kind of thing you might get in like Ray Bradbury. Fahrenheit. Fahrenheit, whatever the temperature is here.
No, it's the other one that I've forgotten the name of.
Clockwork Orange.
No.
1984. Brave New World.
Brave New World, yes.
Okay.
Yes, thank you. Yes. Yeah, so you went to see the smell organ from Brave New World.
I did. But I'm glad that it was the Digital Circus and not Tarzan, because my brother Leon said he'd gone to see a new Tarzan movie in 4DX some months ago. And he said, obviously, the whole thing's set in the rainforest. And so he said it was just like the water spray was constant through the film. So he said it was just really damp. He said it was really unpleasant.
Yeah. Okay. that is a level of surrealism that I hadn't anticipated in this. I just saw it in normal.
Was it packed out?
No. I mean I saw it like a fair bit after it had come out.
Yeah.
So it was half empty.
Was there any like shouting at the screen?
No.
So it wasn't like going to see the Minecraft movie, which I did, in which there was shouting at the screen.
But what was the reaction like in your 4DX screening?
Oh, lots of laughter. Like, I think, you know, to be fair, I'd say, you know, I didn't want to look around me too much, and it wasn't packed out for the 4DX. I did get the impression that some of the autistic kids maybe were a bit overwhelmed or a bit unsure about the 4DX, which is more than understandable. I think generally, like, the kids are enjoying it. Yeah, it definitely got a lot of laughter. And and I think were, as far as I could tell, really engaged in the second half. I mean,
okay,
the second half gets very downbeat.
Yeah, it's emotional. It's character driven.
Listener, I cried.
Oh yeah. I shed a little tear as well. Yeah.
So yeah, the movie comprises, is it episode 8 and episode 9?
Yeah. It's just interesting in itself that happened, that it was popular enough to get a cinema release.
I mean, this is wild, right? That basically independent animated production can go within about, you know, 2.5 years or something, right? From its pilot through to a massive cinema release.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this has happened around the same time that obviously The Backrooms and Obsession have done extraordinarily well at the cinema, and not that long after Markiplier's Iron Lung film was released as well, which is based on a properly weird, obscure indie video game.
Okay, right.
I mean, Iron Lung is a really, really odd itch game, right? So, yeah, I do feel like there's this cultural shift going on that I'm largely excited about. I mean, Obsession was one of the most intense horror film experiences I've ever had in the cinema. I think it's pretty remarkable. And while I don't think Kane Pixel was The Backrooms is quite at that level, it's certainly a really assured piece of work for someone who's still in their 20s. So, yeah, I think actually interesting things are happening in horror. And so you described in a message to me, I don't know if it was after you'd seen the film, but The Amazing Digital Circus like a kind of interesting edge case, and you compared it to Watership Down.
Yes. Okay. So I think it's definitely like, it's very legit to talk about it as children's horror, partly because it has a very young fan base.
Yeah, but I think it has, and not just secondary. Like, you know, at the screening, there are a lot of primary kids.
Yeah. But I think it has a unique niche as far as stuff I've come across. Partly in the very fact that it is suitable for children, like by the way that's usually judged, like whether it has sex, swearing, realistic violence, is part of the horror itself.
That's really interesting. Yeah. Yeah, the fact that, like, Zubal, for instance, is constantly trying to swear.
Yeah.
Which is clearly just part of who Zubal is and can't, right? They're constantly being censored.
Can you toss that back up here?
I don't know. Let's ask him. Hey, Kane!
You fucking asshole!
Yes, Jax?
Look, it's Zubal!
Fuck you!
Ah, there you are.
Yeah, and so I think, Gooseworks, the creator, called the digital circus the setting, like in a Blue Sky poster, a sexless, sanitized purgatory. Where these adult humans, right? All the characters are adults. Jax and Zubal are the youngest. They're canonically 22. King Air is 48. They're adult humans who are in this thing with these wacky cartoon bodies that are created without genitals, and a sensor sticker with a silly sound effect covers their mouth if they swear. And so the fact that they are in this child friendly situation is part of the horror for the adult characters stuck there, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I guess the first Gooseworks thing I watched some years back now was Little Runmo, which is like, okay, it's worth watching. It's just a short film. I didn't realize it was the same person until Matt, my ex's oldest stepkid, pointed this out to me. I was like, oh, yeah, Gooseworks made Little Run Mo. And I actually did watch Little Run Mo when it came out. And it's a very popular short film with a kind of cutesy, goofy platformer game character called Little Run Mo, who is trying to survive their last life, basically. So it's a sort of Mario-style platformer, but they don't want to die and, you know, fall down the hole of eternal doom or get spiked or whatever it is. So in a way, it's very similar in having these very childlike visuals and seemingly a character who you might not expect to be animate or conscious, who is then, you know, fully aware of being in this bizarre environment and experiencing deep existential terror at the fact of their existence.
So,
I guess a very similar thing in terms of, no, I totally see what you're saying, that it's sort of playing with the aesthetics of children's entertainment.
Yeah.
But it's being very self-reflective about that.
Yes. And then there's this kind of sort of extra layer where these characters make really cute, like, plushies and figurines, and there's loads of merch. because they are kind of adorable. But yeah.
Although, I guess, in a way, that I recently rewatched Jurassic Park. But partly because at my school, things are sort of winding down, and the post-16 students, some of them do film studies, and so so I'd stick on a film that might be useful for them. You know, Spielberg gets discussed, they're looking at teen movies. So anyway, we put on Jurassic Park, and I'd sort of forgotten how self-reflective or self-reflexive Jurassic Park is, that obviously it's a theme park and there's lots of Jurassic Park branded boomph and objects in the film. So you see very early on, like, all the Jurassic Park, like, lunchboxes and so on. And a lot of the critique of the film is basically like this great, this thing, Jurassic Park, has just been created in, well, the main reason perhaps it's been created is to make money, right? To be commercial. And that there's a lot of criticism of that, but obviously it's true of the film itself, that Spielberg is very deliberately making a film that he knows off the back of Jaws is going to be a blockbuster. And, you know, it very much sticks to a similar pattern to Jaws very carefully to ensure that it's marketable. So, yeah, I don't think Gooseworks is that cynical, but it is interesting, I guess, that it is so eminently marketable.
Yeah. And I don't begrudge Glitch and Gooseworks the plushy dollars. It's just interesting.
I mean, you know, the same could be said of The Simpsons, right? Or South Park. Or lots of kind of cartoons that are on some level anti-authority or kind of make fun of people selling out and stuff like that.
Yeah, there's only one Bill Watterson, really. He's a bit of a laugh.
I think that's fair.
but yes, to get to my Watership down comparison, I take a little diversion back through children's horror as a genre.
are we going right back to the water babies?
Well, I mean, if it feels relevant, like, you know, I'm always up for bringing in the water babies. You know, not that we talk about niche and relatable content at all, but so in children's horror, most of the time you will have a child or teenage protagonist, understandably. Sometimes they experience something kind of strange or horrific and are kind of disbelieved or ignored or persecuted by the adult world, and this is the kind of not now Bernard model of children's horror, I think, where it's like the horror of there being a monster that wants to eat you, but there's also the horror that the adult world, like including your parents who are meant to protect you, don't care.
Sure. I mean, Gritty's like that as well, right?
Yeah.
The Gritty is a sort of robotic alien monstrous thing. And yet the parents like, no, it's your gran. Be nice to your gran.
Yeah, no, that's a great example, actually. Yeah, I was like, as we always talk about the Demon Headmaster, but like Gritty is also, yeah, very, a very good example of that kind of thing. And it can be used in kind of both sort of fantastical and kind of realistic variations, I guess, like fantastical Night Demon Headmaster and Gritty. But then like in Stone Cold, which we talked about a few weeks ago, it's like a serial killer preying on homeless youth, but the adult world is indifferent or hostile to the protagonist suffering. And then we also have these kind of hero's journey sort of narratives of kind of children or young people kind of leaving their community and caregivers and facing monstrous threats and testing their courage, and maybe like the weird stone of Brisingamen, return to Oz, that sort of those kind of things.
Yeah, I guess the fantasy genre does tend to lend itself towards that, the kind of Tolkien model.
Yeah. And then we have quite a large subset of children's horror where the protagonists are animals. The Deptford Mice, the mouse and his child, and Watership Down, some examples. And kind of children and to identify with the animals, because children are more animalistic than adults, I guess.
And I think kids do often quite like animals, in fairness.
Yeah, yeah. So, but there is usually a young character point of identification. And as I said, in The Amazing Digital Circus, they are all adults. There are not any children anywhere.
Yeah, but Red, Pomni does look little, right?
Yes, yes. Pomni is a little jester. And she does look very cute. And she does have to tell Ragatha at one point that she is not a child. So, yeah. So I don't know if this Watership Down comparison is holds any water. It tickled me. Watership Down is a story of... adult concerns that is situated in a children's space due to being a cartoon and being about rabbits, but these rabbits are like their problems are like finding a safe place to live, securing the survival of their community, escaping a military dictatorship, these sort of things. And the concerns of the digital circus characters are also quite adult. They're kind of alienation and hopelessness, kind of depression and anxiety, body dysmorphia, depersonalization. Like, they're not exclusive to adults, but they're not things you would generally... directed towards children.
Yeah, although maybe it's more relatable to kids now than it would have been, say, 20 years ago. I don't want to blame everything on the internet, but I do think the digital circus's relationship to the internet's really fascinating, because on one level, this is a kind of Black Mirror-like show for kids, about the evils of AI and, more broadly, the digital realm, and having your whole life as stuck within the digital realm. without people knowing the real you.
Mm.
And yet it strikes me as incredibly nostalgic for a certain, maybe older model of the internet. Like before we started recording, and I need to write a Substack post on this because I've not quite worked it out in my head. But the digital circus strikes me as being almost vaporwave for younger Zoomers and Gen Alpha, or what vaporwave is for millennials, the digital circus is for that younger generation. Because vaporwave is all about sort of nostalgia for 80s VHSs and infomercials and on hold waiting music, on call music that most millennials didn't actually experience, or if we did, we were too young to really understand and now remember it. You know, I was born in 1987. I don't remember the 80s. So the version of the 80s I have is one I've got, I guess, from my parents and also the media that was still around. And, you know, whether that's videos I was watching and films that come out in the 80s, or obviously generational things don't just shift overnight. It's not like you get into January 1st, 1990 and suddenly people aren't wearing ridiculous day glow colours anymore, right? that those clothes hung around. So, you know, if you look at photos from, say, 1992, it still kind of looks like the 1980s. And so I guess a lot of millennials have these sort of faint memories of the 1980s, but it's very mediated. And then I guess for kids in the West, you know, you had 9/11, which was sort of confusing and anxiety provoking. And obviously, I mean, I graduated in 2008. I graduated into this massive recession. And it's very easy to sort of look back at the 1980s and think, hey, this was time where the future looked bright, or we were promised, you know, we, like people say, we were promised hoverboards. That you look at the vision of the future given in Back to the Future, maybe not Back to the Future 2, I would say. And that's clearly not how things have worked out. So it's like vaporwave is this sort of hauntological longing for a future that was promised in a time you can't even remember. So it's a very odd thing. But what strikes me about the Amazing Digital Circus is that aesthetically it resembles CD-ROMs. Particularly, I would say. And computer software from the late 90s, early 2000s, that there's no way that Zoomers and Gen Alpha kids remember or experienced. Like, there are times which remind me of, say, like Microsoft Encarta and Encarta's Mind Maze and the weird kind of empty feeling of that. And then particularly 3D Movie Maker and the Microsoft Kids games or software that existed. And its mascot character, Muggsy, Muggsy could easily be playing Kane in the Amazing Digital Circus. This maniacally positive, but very intense, sort of bizarre character whose face looks like a kind of Picasso sculpture.
Oh my God, yes. Sorry, I'm just Googling him to remember my friend, my good friend, Muggsy. Yeah, very much so.
I mean, I was Googling him as well, and I found this great kind of GeoCities site, just dedicated to Muggsy and everything the writer could find out about Muggsy.
I mean, he taught me how to paint with a fine artist program.
He taught me how to make films with 3D Movie Maker.
Yeah, wow, what a guy.
I mean, for those of you who don't, I mean, look up Muggsy.
look him up,
then you'll know who we're talking about. But you know, man of many talents, but also quite maniacal in his way. In 3D Movie Maker, he dons various unconvincing disguises to be the all employees of a movie studio. So whether the director or the cameraman or even the janitor, all of them are Mock Z, as easily determined by his recognisable Scottish accent.
Incredible. Yeah. Sorry, but I fell down a small nostalgia hole. Let's get
Yeah. But I guess what I'm saying is, like, I do think there was a sense of kind of exploration and maybe naivety to kind of CD-ROMs of that period. And even, say, the early internet. Now, I really love the game Hypnospace Outlaw, which is a brilliant game set in a sort of alternative 90s timeline, where instead of the internet you have Hypnospace, and basically all the websites look like GeoCities sites from that time. And obviously with the rise of social media and then web design sites like Squarespace and WordPress, the internet's become very visually homogenized. You know, everything looks the same. You know, it's very controlled. Yeah. Whereas the internet, I remember from my childhood, patchily, at least, you know, was weird and chaotic. I mean, the internet's still weird, but it's like websites were messy.
I could make my background on Neopets a massive picture of Elijah Wood's face and then have, like, scrolling text going across it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
about how much I love Elijah Wood's face. And you could just do that.
Yeah. I mean, my adventure games, point-and-click adventure games website, the Adventure Games Closet, had, like, MIDI music from different adventure games on almost every single page, which played on loop. So you had to listen to it. You had to listen to the music from Simon the Sorcerer if you wanted to read the review or the walkthrough. but it's like that is sort of what you get in the design of the circus itself, and also the character designs, that they're kind of colourful and wacky and chaotic, a bit like sort of early Nickelodeon animations as well. That they don't look like modern cow arts animation designs, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, they are iconographic, but they're kind of messy. Zubul, for instance, Zubul's probably like my favourite character, I guess. Yeah. Zubul was, you know, I think Zubul was very kind of jaded with the whole thing and really just wants to be like setting up their queer bar somewhere in the real world and is fed up, basically. But Zubul looks exactly like a real toy that I had as a kid that I'd completely forgotten about. I'm trying to see what, can you remember what it was called? I don't know if you ever had it.
I didn't.
It was like called, I don't know, I don't say Zorb or something.
I think a Zorb is something else. I think a Zorb might be the big ball that you get inside.
Seeing if I can find out. Oh, Zolo blocks. There you go.
Zolo blocks.
Yeah, so they're like these sort of chunky plastic pieces. So if you look up Zolo blocks, I mean, they look like...
Oh, yeah. Oh, look at them. They're seagulls.
So they look like they've come from a kind of Nickelodeon ident, basically. Yeah. But yeah, they're just
Those are really cute. Yeah.
Yeah, plastic pieces that you stick together to make characters. And yeah, it must be that Gooseworks had Zolo blocks as a kid, because yeah, it really is very close to Zubul's design. And yeah, I happened to also have Zolo blocks. I'd completely forgotten, so that was a real weird, very specific nostalgia kick I got.
And it is like, I don't know, it is also very like it's not animated to look like, say, like it, occasionally they play with it and there are little snippets that look like an N64 game, you know, in that kind of low poly sort of thing, but it doesn't look like that all the time. Like, it looks like good.
Oh, know? I mean, it gets smoother as it goes on. The first episode is a little janky at times, the pilot episode, and then it gets smoother and smoother. But as you say, they mess around with it. I think, is it the third or the fourth episode where they, or it might be like the beach episode is really interesting.
Yeah, I think it's like episode 7.
Oh gosh, it's later. Okay. But it's, the graphics deliberately start breaking down. For instance, it looks weirdly like a Banjo-Kazooie level, I would say.
Yeah.
I mean, I really enjoy, all of that kind of stuff. I find that really interesting and satisfying. And I can see how that leads itself to lore, because one of the things that the youth today sure like is lore and lore icebergs. And I can see how The Amazing Digital Circus lends itself to theories, basically. About, you know, what's going on here? Who built The Amazing Digital Circus? You know, what exactly is Bubble? I know there was some disappointment. I don't want to go full spoilers because...
Okay.
Well, maybe we can a bit, but... Yeah. I guess it has come out on YouTube now, the last episode.
Yeah.
But the last episode arguably simplifies, or it provides certain answers, which are on some level quite straightforward. And looking at the fan reaction... And The Amazing Digital Circus is a very enthusiastic but intense fandom, is the impression I get. I know some people are really unhappy about it, but I think ultimately it's a very character-driven piece. It's not as about the lore as you might assume at first, I would say.
Yeah.
That really it's sort of about, okay, how do these characters react to being stuck in The Amazing Digital Circus, and what are their relationships, and what baggage have they brought with them?
Yeah. Shall we do a texture break before we talk about the horror?
Oh my gosh!
We did
have a terrifying incident where it seemed like I might have lost almost the archives of the entire podcast.
Yes, because I changed bank accounts and. Anyway,
we are as professional, and because we are such professionals, of course, I hadn't actually got most of the recordings on my hard drive, so I was thrown into panic that about 10 years worth of podcasting might just be lost. We would have the transcripts, and I honestly toyed. This is terrible. I feel bad to say it. I thought maybe I'll have to use AI to recreate the episodes. Yeah.
Oh, God, it didn't come to that.
God, I was so caught up with that. I don't know if I've even thought about textures, but I do think I do think we have to sing Texture of the Week. In an upbeat circus children's TV show.
Okay.
Kind of a way. So.
All right.
Like, I don't know.
Texture of the week. Texture of the week.
Texture of the week. Is... okay. Well. I did only. Remember, like, this evening, like, oh, I need a texture. My texture is the abstractions when the abstracted people.
Okay, so when our cast characters give in to despair and they abstract, how would you describe what they look like when they abstract?
They are multi-legged, sort of flickering. Geometric shape, black, but with multicolored glowing eyes all over them. Actually, I think maybe my texture is the kind of aquarium where where they are kept in at the end, at the end. They are, because previously they were put into the cellar, but because you can't unabstract a person, but they make a nicer enclosure for the abstracted people, so Kinga can go and see his wife swimming around. Yeah, I think that's my texture.
It is quite moving at the end and I do like the fact that it's not really explained the degree to which the abstracted versions of the characters have thoughts and awareness. You know, whether these are almost like the kind of ghosts or spirits of characters, like the shadow left behind, whether they are like kind of beasts, whether they effectively have the same kind of thoughts, but they can't articulate and talk, you know, whether it is a kind of, I have no mouth, but I must scream kind of situation. At the end. So I found that interesting. It's not really explained.
It's not. No, it's not. They can be soothed.
That's true. They can be soothed.
Yeah.
Well, I guess, I mean, it's easy, but I guess I'll just go for Zubal then. Because I find Zubal's character design very satisfying. I just want to... I mean, this sounds deviant, but I just want to kind of chew on various Zubal parts, really, to be honest.
Very chewable.
Yeah. And who is the real sick man in a so-called society, man? Is it the man who would pluck apart a children's character chewing on their various anatomies? Or is it the businessman?
Businessman.
It is suit and tie. Making profit from the sale of plushies. Yeah, no, it probably is me wanting to chew on Zubal, but there you go.
you have bought it up, but the Amazing Digital Circus is inspired by the Harlan Ellison short story "I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream" from 1966.
And ye gads, this is not a story that you really want primary school kids reading.
No, my goodness, no. It's that's a weird, unsettling piece of writing. Yeah,
I mean, Harlan Ellison, I think, was basically like a kind of 4chan edgelorder trapped in the body of a very angry, tiny Californian dude. So the basic premise of I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream is that there is a supercomputer. Is it called Am?
Yeah.
Basically, there were kind of nuclear computers set up in the Cold War, I think, America, Russia, and possibly China. And they end up unifying together, reaching some kind of collective AI consciousness called Am. And Am decides that humans really are a plague on the planet and we'd be better off without them. And so annihilates all humanity, but is so enraged by the awfulness of humanity, decides to kind of imprison half a dozen of these unfortunate humans infinitely within itself, basically, and subject them to various digital tortures for all eternity. Which is kind of like the plot of the Amazing Digital Circus.
And it's told from the perspective of Ted, who's like the last remaining one. Because they can't kill themselves, but he realizes that they can kill each other. So he sort of mercy kills the other humans with icicles, and in as a punishment is turned into a great soft jelly thing with no mouth or eyes, by Am. Yeah.
There's a really funny little Easter egg, actually, that I noticed. I'll try to get the clip. In one of the episodes in which Kane is really frustrated because all the Amazing Digital Circus cast are fed up with his adventures. So Kane, the AI, creates these adventures, these scenarios for the humans to enjoy, and they tend to be interminable and violent and not very enjoyable for them, and so they're obviously thoroughly fed up and refusing to go on them, and Kane just lists off a flurry of half-baked ideas, like, okay, you're in a post-apocalyptic wasteland and your only friend's a dog who's really mean to you, and that is the plot of Harlan Ellison's A Boy and His Dog, which I've read.
Oh.
And I do wonder if all of them are just stupid Harlan Ellison stories.
Oh, I hope so.
Because Harlan Ellison has some stupid ass stories. I mean, I kind of... He was a right jerk, Harlan Ellison. You know, he was quite a difficult man to get along with. You know, not a very pleasant man. Always trying to sue Star Trek because he claimed they stole his ideas. Well, trying to sue everyone, basically. Mm. You know, really irascible. I have actually read quite a lot of his writing. And what's sort of weird about Ellison is that by any sensible measure, he's a really bad writer. Kind of like Lovecraft is a really bad writer in a different way. I mean, Lovecraft is bad because... He is constantly trying to be clever, right? Like, constantly trying to show that he's as clever as Edgar Allan Poe. And, you know, he knows long words and bits of Latin too, and lots of adjectives. And it just ends up being a real slog to read, right? Because of these awful run-on sentences with loads of adjectives. Harlan Ellison is just incredibly ugly as a writer. Like the rhythms are horrible. Like there's something really kind of heavy and ungainly and meaty about his writing. Do you get what I mean? You've only read that story, but like
I've read that story, but there was there's a bit early where so they haven't eaten for a month, and it. It says, oh, okay, 3 days. 3 days that have been since we'd last eaten. Worms. Thick. Ropey. Like, whoa. So gross.
Yeah, like the grossness, but also, like he has these sort of thick, stumbling sentences, basically. Mm. Like, they're really graceless. He's a really graceless writer, and yet... He has so much chaputz, he has so much confidence in his own writing that this confidence alone propels him along. Like, it's really hard to explain, but it's like he has these stupid story ideas. Some of his story ideas are just nonsense. It's like, what about gophers? I can't even remember what these gophers do, but like, you know, he'd write any old nonsense that came into his head. And yet... I don't know.
It feels compulsive.
Yeah, he's weirdly compulsive. I say, I think that there's just this level of anger in his writing, and confidence that I don't know. It's hard to explain, but I do find him very readable, even though I kind of don't want to find him readable. Anyway, yeah, Harlan Ellison digression, but he is fascinating. There's a really wild story he wrote called The Beast That Shouted Love at the Heart of the World, which I can't even begin to describe the plot of. Like, it starts off with this sort of true crime type serial killer story, but he ends up becoming like a knight fighting a dragon in the heart of the world or something.
Yeah.
It's really, really trippy. But I just remember it. I don't know. It blew my mind when I read it. Like, I just remember I felt like I'd really gone through something after reading that one. So yeah, a cautious recommendation, because not the nicest man, and there's some really graphic, ugly stuff. I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream, like, has some, you know, properly nasty violence in it.
Yeah.
So it's definitely not suitable for kids. But it's kind of fascinating to think of it as the origin for this incredibly popular
yeah.
kids show.
Yeah, and I think the sort of the main parallel is that of Am with Kane. And in I Have No Mouth, the Am is just straightforwardly out there to torture and torment them. But in throughout the progression of Digital Circus, there's a building tension as we and the protagonists realize, you know, or kind of know that the humans are at Kane's mercy. As Zubal says in episode 4, the only thing holding Kane back is the fact that he likes us. and this comes to fruition in episode 8 with Kane's musical number, the one who's running the show, about how he is God, including the lyric, "Don't need to scream if you ain't got no mouth." If you ain't got a mouth. So, yeah.
I actually think that the writing for Kane, Cusework's writing for Kane, really captures the weird, ingratiating tone of AI.
Yeah.
It's really accurate in terms of how AI sounds if you try to use, you know, ChatGPT or any of them, that they, you know, have been programmed such that they sound very eager to please.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, they're incredibly stubborn and, you know, make these, well, lie all the time. But, you know, it's like hallucinate, right? And make all these weird claims. So it does create this really odd thing where it does feel like you're interacting with a overly keen maniac, basically. And Kane's design, obviously, is just like this mouth and eyes. And I like the fact that, on some level, it's a design that kind of looks fun and wacky. Like, you know, the kind of wind-up teeth you get from a joke shop.
Yeah.
And googly eyes, but obviously is also terrifying.
Yeah. I was reading about it, very difficult to animate, as his teeth have to also express his feelings.
Yeah.
You have to, like, his kind of upper row of teeth, sort of eyebrows. Very, very, very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The character designs are really interesting. I mean, I like Pomni's a lot because I don't think the jester design is inherently that cute. So obviously Pomni has the big eyes. But yeah, you know, Pomni kind of looks slightly freaky, and yet she is cute. I think it's also Pomni's relatable, because I think most of us would probably feel like Pomni if thrust into this situation, like feel overwhelmed and confused.
Yeah.
Although, notably, Gooseworks says that the character she is closest to, or that is most like an authorial insert character, is Jax.
Yes.
Interestingly.
Yeah. And a lot of the final episode is devoted to Jax. To some people's consternation, but
I think Jax's story is clearly emotionally important to Gooseworks, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I appreciated that taking the time to really explore that of like why, you know, why is he like that? Because it's been building, you know, why is he so resistant to getting close to any of the other characters, and I think it's episode 6 when they have guns, Pomni and Jax team up and a sort of bonding, and then Jax totally rejects that any idea that they were becoming close, and you know, and we learn why that is.
I'm personally open to, you know, there's this reading I've seen online that Jax is meant to be transcoded, and that does make a certain amount of sense to me. I think Gooseworks leaves it pretty open, basically. Like, I actually think Gooseworks in some ways is quite careful to, I don't know, like, not tie. It's really interesting. I think Gooseworks sometimes deliberately doesn't tie down the characters' identities. Or, okay, the last episode, this is a spoiler, so if you really don't want spoilers for the last episode, then stop now, or maybe go forwards till like 5 minutes before the end. So the last episode reveals, Black Mirror like, that the characters are all brain scans, and so they are effectively digital constructs with the memories of real people. Okay, now these real people obviously have gender, racial, and sexual identities, right? That are concrete and grounded in the so-called real world and the everyday world. What is interesting, and maybe a bit confusing, but interesting, is that the characters we are left with on some level aren't exactly real people. They are, you know, they're simulacra, right? That they are code that have the memories of real people. So in some ways it doesn't really make sense to talk about, say, Pomni as having a real body. Pomni is Pomni. And in some ways the last episode underlines this. Like, this is how these characters are able to accept their future, you know, which might go on. They don't even know how long they're going to exist for, basically. They're going to exist for as ever long the computer system exists, basically. Without aging. So they have to kind of accept that they are who they are, right? That they are these digital beings on some level, aren't completely tethered to their real life human equivalents. Which then does something very complex, because like you talked about, like, oh, these are characters, they're adults, and yet they've been rendered sexless, right? And that means they were always sexless, technically. That they've never actually experienced having a real body in the sense of a human body, for instance. And that's really interesting. On some level, it's like, that's quite a troublesome message, because, you know, we might want to say, right, what we want for the youth generally is for them to be able to integrate their digital selves and to realise that your online life is sort of part of your everyday life, and to, you know, have sort of reasonable, have a healthy relationship, I guess, between your online life and your offline life. And what the ending kind of suggests is that your online life is just as, if not more, maybe, ontologically valid as your offline life. That it has reality in and of itself, right?
Hmm.
That your online avatar is real and just as real as your human avatar. And online, you can kind of be who you want to be. Like, say, you know, I'm pretty sure that I'm a cis guy. Like, for instance, now I could pretend to be a woman online. Now I'm not going to do that. I could, I suppose, if I wanted to leave comments like that.
Yeah.
But that would be a lie. That would be fake because that's not me.
Yeah.
So we know that that's not. That's because there's a relationship between the online me and the offline me. You know, there is a real me. But by the end of the show, there isn't really a real them, apart from the online version. So what I'm saying is it then becomes very confusing as to whether it makes sense to say that Jax is trans or, you know, Pomni... you know, is gay, or because suddenly these terms don't quite. Do you get what I'm saying? It's quite a confusing thing to try to articulate. But basically, it's like their world, yes. Their identities only exist within their world.
Yeah.
So yes. It's quite. I don't know. I think it becomes quite odd because it's then they and we see their human. Kind of counterparts right at the end of the end credits going on a bus.
Mm.
And on some level, it's like, oh, this is the reveal of the real them. But
yeah,
it's also not.
Yeah. Yeah. yeah.
Like, in a way, the Pomni plushie is closer to the real Pomni than any human being.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And I mean, I think that's probably really important for the audience on some level, right? Because it's validating your investment in these funny-looking characters, you know, in a little squidgy gesture or a creature made up of colourful parts or that... You're invested in them in that form, that they don't need to have human equivalents.
Yeah. But it's also interesting because, and I'm just like thinking about this on the fly. So
yeah.
I watched the final episode and I immediately I was like, oh, Jax, this is saying to me, Jax is trans femme.
Yeah.
Right? That is what this is saying. But then there's also this layer of like, what does that even mean? Because, as you're saying, this the Jax has only ever existed as a rabbit guy.
Yeah.
And then we see the real person, the human being.
Yeah.
That Jax's brain scanned from, who has also still referred to with. He, him pronouns. So the transness of Jax is still a potential unembodied truth.
It does something. No, it does something. It does something very, very odd, basically.
Yeah.
it's like the furry suit never contained a person.
Yeah, it's quite a lot to get your head around.
Yeah, to be and fair, that's quite a philosophically deep idea for a kids' show, right? This is like quite. I say, and I actually think in some ways it's exploring this with more depth than the ostensibly for adults Black Mirror does.
Oh yeah, do we want to? I have written some little Black Mirror notes.
Have you? Okay, yeah.
Just, I think as British millennials, it's just very, it's very in there for us. I think. And yeah, it is something, this sort of digital copies kind of territory is something that Charlie Brooker covered several times. I think, did you like remember the Christmas special?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
From 2014.
One of my favourite episodes, that one.
Yeah, which introduces the idea of digital clones that people use as their own personal assistants, but they kind of have to be trained or sort of essentially tortured into submission because they, like the characters in Digital Circus, feel themselves to be human beings, but they are made to do menial tasks for their human counterparts. And then at the end of this episode, the man who did this training is trapped in a digital egg where he's forced to listen to Merry Xmas Everybody by Slade for thousands of years, I think.
It's similar actually to the way that the outies treat the innies in Severance. Have you seen that?
I haven't.
It's good actually. I don't watch much TV, but I like Severance. I watched it with my parents. And in that, people's brains are kind of split so that their work self is different, has no memory of being their at-home self, basically. Mm. So the work self is stuck in a perpetual purgatory of always being at work, and the home self doesn't have to go to work.
Okay, yeah. So I guess that's where I'd sort of, you know, and there's a 2017 episode called USS Callista.
Oh yeah.
In which a man makes digital copies of his co-workers to sort of play with in his Star Trek spaceship.
Yeah, yeah.
And at one point he demonstrates his control over one of them by removing her mouth. So you know, there's that influence. You can see that influence there.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting to me is that Gooseworks is very much a millennial creator who's made work that really appeals to a younger generation. So, you know, the influences here are the influences that a millennial would have and some of those concerns. And yet it's something that clearly speaks to a massive number of young people. Clearly in terms of their relationship, I guess, to the internet or their uncertainty about the future, it's something that really clicks.
Yeah, thanks for suggesting we talked about it. I enjoyed it. I'd seen the first couple of episodes when they came out and then sort of forgotten about it.
Oh, so cool.
I really enjoyed going back to it and watching the whole series.
Yeah, and I do think it is horror, right? Like, I don't even think it's horror adjacent. I'm comfortable in saying that it's horror. I mean, I'm so bad at remembering which episode, but the episode where they have the horror themed
adventure. Episode 3.
Okay, episode 3, I think, is to me very explicitly inspired by the Amnesia games.
Oh, okay.
I mean, like, it really, the kind of creepy mansion they're in really looks like it's a mansion from Amnesia the Dark Descent or Amnesia Machine for Pigs. And that's really interesting because the Amnesia games were like some of the first horror games that YouTube streamers who are popular with that generation, or certainly popular with Zoomers, got started with. Like, if someone like Markiplier, for instance, started off doing Let's Play games of Amnesia. I mean, obviously, people think of Five Nights at Freddy's, but actually, yeah, the Amnesia games were really popular. For YouTubers, let's play videos, I find it really interesting to think, you know, the Amnesia games are very much for adults, and yet quite a few kids, maybe sort of older Zoomers, like those who are now in their late teens, early 20s, would have maybe not played the games, but certainly have seen people like Markiplier playing them on YouTube and seeing their reactions.
Mm.
So it really struck me as the aesthetics of that episode are very much the aesthetics of horror games that they would have seen YouTubers play, basically.
Yeah.
And obviously the kind of look of the kind of
it's quite similar to a Final Fantasy 14 dungeon as well. There's a haunted manor in that. It reminds me of that.
That's interesting. I was going to say that also the offices where the computer on which the digital circus is running looks like the Stanley Parable.
Yes, it does, doesn't it? Yeah.
Like very much like the Stanley Parable. And obviously, today really recalls the back rooms as well.
Mm. We've been talking for a little while, shall we?
Yeah, we can wrap it up. I mean, it's definitely a show that I could probably talk about for hours. Like, there's a lot.
Know, yeah.
It's really interesting. There's a lot going on.
Mm. Really enjoy talking about it. Thanks, Adam.
Oh, that's okay. Thank you.
I don't think we have a plan for our next.
No, I mean, it's your choice.
Is it?
Okay. It is your choice. So we can discuss it after we've finished recording. Obviously, we're not going to do Robert Cormier again for probably another 10 years, but I have been watching the film of I Am the Cheese, which is really interesting.
Thank you for listening. Our credits are intro musics by Maki Yamazaki, our outro musics by Joe Kelly, our artworks by Nettie Wilson. You can email us at stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com.
I did reply to emails the other day.
We eventually get round to replying, and we do appreciate them. And you can follow us on Instagram at stillscaredpodcast, where I do a little collage for each episode.
Ooh, I'm enjoying the one for this week. Digital Circus? I mean, your last one is really good, but I mean, I'm just very intrigued to see what you're going to do for the amazing Digital Circus.
Well, let's see. Do you have a sign off for us, Adam?
Yes, although I will quickly say, if you do want to review us to fight back against the AI fake news.
The fake news that we talk about niche topics and amateurs.
Exactly. Then
I can't believe I'd say such slander. Yeah.
I think you have to review us on Apple Podcasts because I'm going to admit it. I made a call out. I've never reviewed my own podcast. That would be too pathetic. But I have asked. I have asked my family to do so. My dad pointed out that would require him to listen to an episode of my podcast, which I think was a bit rude, actually. He did try to review it on Spotify, but couldn't find a way. So, but it seems like Apple Podcasts, whatever they call it, is your best bet, really.
Yeah. And remember, we've never got round to monetizing this. So,
We're never going to monetize this.
We're never going to, because we're so principled.
Yeah, we are like Bill Watterson or whatever he's called.
We are the Bill Wattersons of podcasting.
Yeah. thanks for listening, creepy kids, and don't get abstracted. Don't give in to despair.
Yeah. See you next time, spooky kids.
Bye.
Bye.